I was in like the middle of a deep depression, like coming out of this deep depression. I got a job as an extra and I got onto the set. And this was months of, oh, I don't know what I'm doing in my life. I don't know what's happening. And I got onto the set and I was like, oh, this feels like home.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Making It Women in Film. My name is Savita, and I'm a writer, lover of film, and the host of this podcast, which features weekly interviews with women working across the film and TV industry, in front and behind the camera. Now, this week, I got to sit down with screenwriter and filmmaker Lorna King. She's just so wonderful to speak to, and in this episode, she really takes us through a very realistic entry into the film industry, which I think a lot of you will find very insightful, and talks about the good and the bad that comes along. In particular, she gets into her process of getting a master's in screenwriting, what it's been like navigating the industry as a black neurodivergent woman, and her thoughts on how the industry really treats mental health concerns. Now, if you do enjoy our show, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and maybe even throw up a screenshot of you listening to us on Instagram. You can tag us at Making It Women in Film if you do so, and we'll come say hi over there. Thank you all so much for continued support, and without further ado, let's just get into it. Enjoy. And I am here with Lorna King. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good. I'm good. And how are you?
Very good. Very excited to speak with you today. Now, Lorna, for people who aren't already familiar with what you do, can you tell me a bit about, you know, who you are as a filmmaker? Just introduce yourself to the people. What should they know about you?
Gosh, it's always been hard to do this. And yeah, I've done it so many times. So I am a screenwriter. I have to say filmmaker because really you're never just stuck in one part of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm primarily a screenwriter into filmmaking. I have a bit of a performance background. And I guess that's it, actually.
Well, you know, we're going to get the whole life story here today. So that's why you're listening. You're listening to get to know her. So let's scroll back to the very beginning. When did you first fall in love with storytelling? Like, do you have any early memories? Has it always been part of you? What was it like growing up?
For sure. I mean, so many really early memories. I realized when I was talking to my mom the other day that I actually remember a lot further back than I thought. I thought my earliest memory started from maybe when I was 3. But she showed me a picture and I was like, oh, I remember that. And it was my first birthday.
Oh my God.
So I remember a lot. So I have loads of early memories of watching films, particularly The Sound of Music, The King and I. A bit later on, it was the Ten Commandments. This is a specific Ten Commandments, right? And this is the one that was directed by Cecil B. DeMille, which came out in 1956. And I have to say all that because Cecil B. DeMille made an earlier version, but it sounds so pretentious to say all that. And yeah, I have to be specific. But yeah, super early memories of literally just sitting behind the TV watching these films constantly. And it was because my grandfather was a filmmaker. And I think he must have been studying these films and taking notes because he watched Sound of Music and The King and I, and also a version of Romeo and Juliet. It was made in 1968 or released in 1968. And it was Romeo and Juliet, by the way, was not suitable for children, but
oh,
he
no.
did not care. but yeah, so he watched a lot on repeat. So I watched these films on repeat. And I mean, I just loved being transported into a different world. I mean, you know, Sound of Music being set in Austria. I'd never seen anything like Austria. You know, Maria singing in the mountains was the most stunning thing I'd ever seen. I mean, I love that sort of thing. And the music is so gorgeous. And, you know, I adore that kind of thing. And I was born in Ghana. So I spent my childhood in Ghana. And Africans in general were super big on storytelling. So it was never something I had even considered as outside of me. It was just part of life. So it was just the way things were. And I loved it because I was also a very over the top kind of child. but yeah, storytelling has definitely always been a part of my life. It definitely helped to think that my grandfather was a filmmaker. But that being said, it didn't make me think that I could get into film. It wasn't even something that occurred to me, strangely enough, because the fact that I had this love of storytelling, I didn't feel like it qualified me to become a storyteller, because I love people telling me stories. I became a really avid reader as well. I loved reading stories. So I thought I was always that person that was, oh, tell me a story and I'll enjoy it, you know? So I never knew that I could be on the other side of it, telling stories. That came a lot later.
Yeah, wow. So when do you think, like, when did you first start writing?
Gosh, I would say, when I was 12, I wanted to be a novelist. I mean, that's how much I read books. I wanted to write my own book. And I had a pretty good idea about that time, actually. And I might actually even still write it, but we'll see. But at that point, I started writing and saving onto a floppy disk, because that's how long ago this was. I know. And I'd write a couple of pages of whatever story I was telling and just be like, yeah, this is great. And I'd go away for like an hour or two, come back to it and be like, this is the worst thing I have ever seen. And I wasn't surrounded by sort of other people being like, yeah, of course it's going to be bad. One, you're a child. And two, you've just started doing it. You just have to keep going and you get better. That's how it goes. But I was so used to the fact that I had to be good at everything the minute I started doing it. So I just thought, well, clearly writing's not for me. I'll just carry on reading my books. And, you know, that's just the way I carried on until, gosh, this would have been 2016. Was that 5 years ago now? Almost 6 years ago now. I was in like the middle of a deep depression, like coming out of this deep depression. I got a job as an extra and I got onto the set, and this was months of, oh, I don't know what I'm doing in my life. I don't know what's happening. And I got onto the set and I was like, oh, this feels like home. What do I need to do to come home? Like things don't click in life so easily. Well, very rarely anyway. And that was one of those moments that clicked really quickly. And I was like, oh, this is it. This is the thing that I'm supposed to do. So what skills do I have to come to this point, essentially? And so I started writing bits and bobs. I knew I would be terrible. But at that point, I was like, just write something. And then you can say, so you've written something. And then you can carry on, because you can't get worse. So I started just doing little bits and bobs. And of course, they were terrible. But you have to write something. You have to be bad at first to then get good at something. And it's hard. It's really hard to do it, because no one likes to be bad at anything. So I did that and I just thought, okay, I'll just do little bits and bobs. But the thing that really, really pushed me over the edge was, this was back when The Avengers was filming in Edinburgh. So I think this was like early 2017, I think.
Yeah, it must be.
Yeah, I think so. And literally they had, I booked that job as an extra for the stuff that they were filming in Edinburgh. And I was like, this is amazing. I was working at a Wetherspoons at the time. And I was like, I could quit my job because I was going to make more in like 2 weeks of this job than I would have in like 3 months of working at Wetherspoons. So I was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. It'll be fun. And then they just kept canceling me. And then they were like, oh, we don't need you anymore. And I was raging. And I mean, I can't begin to tell you how angry I was. I was like, how dare you? They make me sign the NDAs. You made me like get into the costume people, I had to send clothes to the costume people. I was so angry. And I was like, if I had written this, they couldn't just treat me that way. And that was what I was so angry. It pushed me to write like a full length play. I literally stayed up all night for like 2 weeks just writing a terrible play. The idea is all right, but the writing wasn't good. But then I was like, finally, I've written something that's a full length thing and I finished it. I can do something else now. And the reason I even wrote a play was because I was intimidated by the format of a screenplay. At least with a play, I could just kind of do it on Word. But screenplays look very specific font to specific, like things need to be in.
Yeah, the margins, places. Everything.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I was just like, I don't want to go anywhere near that. I can't put any more obstacles in my way. I just need to write something. But then once I'd written the play, which of course went nowhere, I then found out that there's like free software to be able to write screenplays with. And I was like, oh, okay. I can write films. I can be that person that could write The Sound of Music, or like, you know, I was super, super psyched to be getting into film. So yeah, that's how I got into writing. I just got really angry one day.
Oh my God. I mean, yeah, you should have been angry. That's so ridiculous. I mean, and that is how it, like, that sucks how, extras are treated that way. That's ridiculous. You said that it felt like home when you were on that first TV show. Can you tell me a bit more about, like, was it the filming aspect? Was it being on set? All the people? What was it that really that you gravitated towards?
I'm just trying to think of anything specific. It was just because I think that was like my first day, especially. I didn't really know how a set ran. I didn't know what people were called. Like I really thought when you've never been on a set and you're suddenly on a big set, the first AD is the person you think is the director. And it took me like half the day to realize that, oh no, actually the director is the really quiet guy that's just walking in the background. Doing very much, but that's actually the director. I'm the first AD is the one that's shouting and doing sort of the most. So it was little things like that, and I don't know if it was like the equipment that was around or just seeing like the amount of attention to detail, because obviously filming anything, you're maybe filming 2 pages, and that is even 2 pages is a lot, and that could be a whole day. Because it's like we need to get it from this angle, we need to get it from that angle, we need to make sure the continuity is right, we need to do this then. And I think that's something that really appealed to me, actually, that attention to detail. I mean, it's like at the end of the day, when you if you're just telling stories, you think that's pretty trivial, but actually the amount of care that these people take in something that seems to be trivial is something that really struck a chord with me. And I was like, this could be something more than just a trivial thing. Something more than just a money-making thing. Like it would be something, with real magic to it. And I just there's nothing else like it. So I think that's what really attracted me to it. That's what made me feel like it was home,
Yeah, definitely. I think there's just something magical about how so many people come together. So many people. Like, I know some people hate to sit through the credits or don't, but I love to seeing all of the different titles, all the different roles. I'm like, wait, someone did that? Because it's like, you're like, huh? That's
I
even a
know, right?
thing? It's
I love
amazing.
it. I love it. It's like every single person that does anything on a film is credited. And I love that. And I'm grateful to Marvel, even though they screwed me in such a tiny way, but kind of grateful to Marvel that they make people sit through for like the end credits and stuff. Cause now I don't look like a weirdo when I'm watching a normal film and I'm just like, oh, credits, you never know. Like, cause I love watching credits. I love being like, oh, what's a grip? What is like,
What
oh,
are
the
all
person
these
was
best boys?
like, exactly. I love that sort of thing. And it's like, I don't know, like I'm curious about it. Well, I mean, I know a bit more about it now, but that curiosity, right? It's just, there's nothing like the creative industry, I don't think.
No, good point. Yeah, if we can give Marvel something, it's that they have made people sit through so many credits. Like, that is good. And then, so when was it you decided to study screenwriting?
It was actually my mom's idea, which was really nice. I got a lot of support from my family, which was great because I felt like I was very much the black sheep. Like my brother has like a job in finance and he lives in London, and my sister is like she's currently doing her PhD, but she's always been like the really smart one. And then there was just me who was like, what is she doing with her life? So it was actually always really nice to get that support. So then my mom was like, all right, you're doing these little things here and there. Why don't you just go back to school for it? Because I'd done my undergrad in psychology and I was like, oh, yeah, why didn't I think about that? And I remembered like a lot of people I knew had been to Napier, Edinburgh Napier, and they were doing really, really well. And I just thought Edinburgh Napier seems to have a really great program as well. So that was the only uni I applied to. I didn't apply anywhere else. Because I was like, look at this program, this is what I need, this is what I'm looking for. So that I applied because mom was like, hey, do it. And then I applied and I actually got in, which was crazy because the like when I got into the program, there are other people who had so much more experience. And I was like, how did I get on this program? I don't understand why they picked me, because there were only like 17 of us. And yeah, I'm sure more people had applied. So it was I just felt very blessed to be able to get on because it helped me out so much. I can't even begin to tell you.
Yes, so learning kind of the screenwriting structure and everything that came with it, how do you think, like, what influence do you think studying at Napier has had on the way you approach work? And I mean, surely, I mean, it's probably influenced everything, right? Like, because, yeah.
Yes, it's influenced everything because it's you know, no matter how much attention I paid, there were things I just couldn't just glean by myself. So I didn't always know what I was doing wrong. And it can be really disheartening when you're just like sending your script off to competitions and stuff, and they never give you feedback. So you have absolutely no idea if you're going in the right direction or the wrong direction. So I was like, I need to just sit down and learn this. Somebody teach me. And they were just incredible because, I mean, really learning about the structure and then having other, you know, other people who are in the business being like, these are the books that helped me. You know, this is the advice that helped me. Here you go. Beyond invaluable. And really being able to, like, you really go through the ringer on that MA. This is not an easy course at all. I mean, it was an ordeal by fire every day for a year. So yeah, so literally you had to really learn it, and you're really faced with your weaknesses very quickly. You have to learn to share with other people. So you can't do the course if you're kind of like, oh, I don't think my writing's very good, I don't want anyone to see it. There's no room for that. You are in groups, and it's like, okay, let's read each other's scripts, we're giving each other feedback. Some feedback can be harsh. It's always fair though. Like there's always someone who was there, like a tutor would always be there and be like, you have to critique the work, not the fact that you don't like this kind of genre or whatever. Like it can't just be personal like that. So yeah, it was very it was a lot. So you learn the structure sort of by force. Like you can't not learn it, especially if you're trying to be better. So I remember like the first few weeks we the MA is split into three trimesters at Napier. So the first trimester, we had to do a portfolio of short scripts. So they just for short films. And we had to do a script for a 1 minute film, script for a 3 minute film, and a script for a 10 minute film. And then in the second trimester, we had to write a TV pilot. And in the third trimester, you could write either a feature film or two episodes of TV. And it couldn't be a continuation from the TV pilot you wrote before. It had to be something completely different. And that short module, I mean, I was like, have I made a mistake? Because one of my weaknesses is overwriting easily. I just write, I'm so into details. Details nobody cares about, but I love my details. I love specificity. And if you're writing a script for a 1 minute film, it has to be one page because that's sort of the rule of thumb, a minute per page. And that's when you start to realize that, oh, dialogue really eats up the page count. And I love dialogue. And I couldn't fit in like any dialogue pretty much for the script to work. And I was like, no, this is impossible. I can't do it. And yet somehow I managed to find a way. And that's when I realized that, oh, okay, no, I can, all right. I just have to just keep working, just keep chipping away. So that was, it's kind of like that example that I gave in the article that I wrote for Black Ballad about storytelling and whatnot, but how it's literally like you're chipping away at a bit of marble. The marble is just its thing, but you have to make the shape out of it. And you can make whatever shape out of it that you want, whether it's good or not, you know, it's up to you and it's up to the beholder, you know. So yeah, it was learning structure. I mean, I cannot emphasize how important structure is. Cannot overemphasize it. You need to do it because I've written stuff without structure and I'm like, wow. Wow. I knew it was bad. I just didn't know why it was bad or how it was bad. So it's a way of one of the things that Emmy taught, ways of, you know, being able to critique creative work in a way that is actually useful and not just like, oh, this is the type of thing that will sell or people seem to like this sort of story. Like there's that's not helpful. But being able to say, oh, all stories universally tend to follow a certain structure. Just try it and see, and then you realize it works. That's what makes the story work. So
So yeah, besides story structure, what were like some of your biggest, like, was there a moment that you were considering quitting, or did you power through it all the way?
I was always going to power through, even when I was like, I don't think I'm good enough. And I had those moments a lot that I just didn't think that I was good enough. But very quickly, I was just like, at this point, it doesn't matter if you're not good enough. Because I realized, you know, with watching other people who we were all in the same boat, you know, I realized that some people just had this knack for being able to tell a story really, really well, even if the actual content of the story isn't like exciting necessarily. And that's what I really realized. I was like, you can be taught that. You might not be able, you can't get taught ideas. You know, they come to you like it's your outlook on life that influences the stories that you tell. But how you tell stories, you can be taught how to do that. So I really just sort of knuckled down and was like, okay, how can I, like, a story that could be boring, is there a way I can tell it that can make it exciting and not even change the story? Because, like, we've all had that experience where someone is telling, you know, what should be a pretty good story, but they're telling it in a way that you're just like, oh, hurry up, move on, sort of thing. But someone else can tell a pretty, like, pedestrian story. You've heard it a million times, but the way they tell it, you're super engaged. And I found that that was what was more important to me. How to tell any kind of story is more important than the actual story. So I did that helped me out of that sort of rut of, oh, I don't think I'm good enough. You know, other people have had so much more experience and they've done this sort of thing before. But once I had that, I was like, okay, let me see what my strengths are, the kind of stories that I just like to tell, and then learn how to tell them in a proper way that engages people. So I think once I got to that point, I was like, yes, let's do this, let's go. After that, though, it was mostly just stress. The stress is like me. Honestly, the stress of meeting deadlines was humongous. I don't think I could do it again, honestly, knowing what it was like. But it was so useful. It was so helpful. And I mean, I'm really, really, really glad I did it. I would not be here if I hadn't done that course, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's definitely had more of an influence than just a diploma and a CV.
For sure. More than even just a piece of paper. I mean, they don't just teach you about writing, but they teach a lot about how the industry works, which is something else that you don't readily get from if you don't know someone in the industry already. And I didn't know anyone in the industry. But it's a lot of like, this is how studios tend to work. This is what coverage is. You know, you have to write a report. It's only one page. You have to summarize this, and that needs to be in it. So our assessments were really not just writing, which was terrifying. Oh, we had to do market research, which I was not good at, but I managed to pass by the skin of my teeth, and I was like, never again. But there's a purpose to all of it. It really prepares you to be an active player in the industry. Whereas before that, I would just have been writing stuff and sending it away and not really knowing how things work and how to try and make things work in my favor. So yeah, that course, and really the biggest thing actually was meeting my course mates on that course. Please, 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 anyone who is in the creative industry, especially if you're a writer, because writing is pretty solitary, please, please have a group of other people that you can talk to about stuff. Because otherwise you will drive yourself completely crazy. You need to have your course mates around you because you're going through the same experience. We were all going through that stress. We were all going through those self-doubt moments. We were all, you know, trying to get films made. We're all going on a similar career trajectory. So, you know, you need to have people like that you can talk to, people like that when you write something, you can say, oh, can you critique this? Or you can critique their work. You sharpen each other, you make each other better. And that really might be the biggest thing. These people have been around me. I could not be more grateful because, oh, this industry.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we'll get to that. And so after that, like, what were your next steps? You said stress.
I know, literally, well, I collapsed. Like, I couldn't function. Which is just as a weakness of mine, because not everyone suffered that, where I was just trying to put so much into it. And it had been such, you know, a year of just constantly going that the minute I was done and I stopped, I just fell apart. And this was for a good number of months. And I was just sort of starting to recover by the time we graduated in November. This was November 2019. So January 2020 seemed like, okay, let's see what we can do. Let me get back into writing. Let's, you know, there are a few schemes and things that, because we have a group on Facebook as well, people will be sending links or reminders. Like, we're in touch with our old tutors as well, who will send things and be like, oh, this is something to apply for. This is something you might be interested in. And I was aiming for, I was like, I can't write something long right now. I'm like, please, please no. So I just kind of went back to shorts because I then really liked writing short scripts at that point. So then I went back to a short that I'd written on the course. And I was like, okay, let me see if I can sort of polish it up a bit more. and, you know, perhaps give it into the scheme. And the scheme at that point was called SFTN, the Scottish Film Talent Network, which is no more. There's another group of people that took over it, and that they're called Short Circuit. They're called Short Circuit, and the program that they do is Sharp Shorts. Anyway, I was like, okay, let me aim for that, because they have very specific rules. I managed to write one of the grad films, which is a really nice experience. And so I was eligible to submit this thing, because you have to have had a credit in something, including a short film, like it could be a short film. So I was like, okay, let me aim for that. And then COVID came along and it was like, oh, never mind. So then I crashed again with COVID, because I tend to not do well with new things, or at least like you couldn't rely on anything when COVID hit. If you can't get toilet paper, like I would do like a big, because I was also caring for my mum, and you know, you do a big ASDA shop, try and get everything that we need. Everything is available at the time that you shop for it, and then you know, the day that it comes, like three items would come. That happened several times, and I was like, I can't, there's nothing I can hold on to, there's no foundation. Like, so that made me also kind of dip again. But then Sharp Shorts opened up in like the June, and I was like, okay, let me maybe try. And I had like, there was a friend of mine that was like, okay, why don't we try and apply with this script, because I really like the script, let's try and do it. So eventually I kind of got back out of that rut, and I applied, and we actually got in onto the shortlist. And that shortlist also had like classes, master classes, you meet other people on it. And I met amazing people on that, on Sharp Short shortlist. So that kind of started to get me back out there. And that was something that's really helped my career thus far, because it feels a bit like, oh, you've been co-signed by, you know, the BFI's delivery partner in Scotland. So that must be something, right? So yeah, it's like little baby steps. Just lots and lots and lots of baby steps.
Now I want to talk a bit about mental health. As a neurodivergent Black woman in this industry, what's it been like navigating a place that's, well, mainly made by white and neurotypical men?
Yeah, it's pretty exhausting. I mean, I am, you know, self-identified, self-diagnosed autistic, because I'm actually writing a TV pilot about an autistic woman. So it made me do research, and I was like, oh, this is me. This has always been me. What the hell? And so I just haven't got an official diagnosis yet, but I'm going through the process, and I'm terrified. But it is exhausting, especially if you don't know. This is like, I feel like it's split into two things. So if you're neurodivergent and you don't know, you're just tired all the time and you don't know why. And it's very, you know, you are a bit like, why can't I just be like my peers who can go to this after party and go to work the next day? You know, like I've never been able to do that. But at least once you know, it does make things a bit easier, because you realize it's not weakness, it's not laziness. Your brain just works differently. You need different supports than a neurotypical person does. So it's something that I'm having to really carve out my own space in that sense, because I have a really bad habit of feeling like a burden, or feeling like, oh, I'm not reliable enough for this, or I don't know when I'm gonna like fall apart again, sort of thing. Rather than like, I see myself as a problem rather than the system is only designed to benefit a specific type of person. So it's something that I have to keep reminding myself of, and carving out that space and having the confidence to be like, I'm at capacity. I'm really sorry. I can't do this, or I can't do that. And that even includes jobs I've already taken on, which is terrifying. And I mean, this literally just happened about a week ago now. So I'm also writing a comic book. So this is like Shah Nazir and Gary Chudley, and they both run BHP Comics. And they were the first people to do the first Scottish Comic Con ever. Like, yeah. And so they print and they write and they illustrate. I mean, they are fantastic. And they did a specific drive looking for people of color who are writers and illustrators for comics, so that at least you can start building up your credits. Because again, they're always like, oh, you have no credits, rather than looking at the work that you can do, you know.
Yeah, need credits to get credits. Yeah,
exactly. It's the worst thing ever. But yeah, they've been really fantastic, and I've been writing this comic book with them. And I just like, especially from like December, I got really, really sick again, and I've had all these deadlines, and I was trying so hard to do all this writing and stuff. And then earlier this year, so gosh, maybe a week and a bit ago, I just was like, this is literally how I'm feeling. Like I'm barely keeping it together. And they were like, do you know what? That's totally fine. We still want to work with you. So let's see, what is your limit? What do you think you can do? Just let us know. And they've been so supportive. And I was just like, I can't believe that there are people this supportive in real life. Like, it's not a film. What? And it's helped me so much to know that it's possible. It really is just a choice that people make to be accommodating or not be accommodating. And the fact that they're a small, BHP Comics is a small outfit, but they're still willing to be like, okay, she's kind of going through a crisis right now, rather than completely leaving her alone. Let's actually ask her what she wants to do. What does she feel comfortable doing? There's no, you know, they're not forcing me to do anything. There's no pressure, no coercion. It's just they're being accommodating of someone who is a bit different. And I honestly could not be more grateful to them. So it's the sort of thing where, in carving out my own space, I've also been really lucky to find other people that are helping me carve out that space. Because once you've done it, once you've been able to say, I can't do this, or I'm not comfortable with this, or this is my limit, once you've done it, it's easier to do it again. And then it gets even easier to do it again. So it's, I feel like they don't necessarily realize what a big thing that they've done in being so accommodating. But I think it's something that the industry needs to take on.
Hey, it's me, Ivica from the future. I just wanted to check in on you. Are you staying hydrated, caffeinated, and most importantly, enjoying the show? If so, why not take a screenshot right now? Slap it up in your Instagram story and tag us at Making It Women of Film. I will personally come thank you and share it on our story. This season, we really want to incorporate you listeners into the show. You're the reason we're still doing this, which is why, from now on, we'll give two random follow shoutouts every episode. All you have to do is follow us on Instagram, tag us in a post, and you might be chosen. We also want to hear from you if you have any feedback. So if you have anything you want to say, anything you want to listen to more, anything you don't want to listen to, any questions you have for our guest or for us, you can email us at miwif.feedback@gmail.com. Now, good luck and thanks for listening. Now, let's get back into the interview.
Because otherwise, it's just shutting people out of an industry that they want to be in. There's no reason that they shouldn't be in it. It was something that I had was doing myself, but on like a smaller scale. So whenever we were networking in person, like there would always be one or two people that were really shy about just approaching people because it's still not an easy thing to do. So I would just be like, oh yeah, just come with me, and then I'd start a conversation with someone, and then the three of us would be talking, and like that's the way that they found it a bit easier. So it's literally just going slightly out of your way to help someone else. Like you don't, it's not a lot, you know, no skin off your nose. But yeah, this industry has a long way to go in accommodating neurodivergent people. I mean, the blind spot in neurodivergence and disability is massive, absolutely massive. I even, you know, I know there was a producer, Misha McCullough, who was just fantastic. She was looking up buildings that were accessible for a shoot. And I mean, it was damn near impossible to find a place that was wheelchair accessible for a shoot. And I'm just like, so what if she was going to hire a GOP that uses a wheelchair? It's so structural, you know, and it's not just in the film and TV industry. It's everywhere. Therefore, it's also in the creative industry. So it feels like we're trying to fight, you know, these huge systems that have been there forever, but it has to be done. That's the only choice we've got. We have to fight it because they have to change or die, you know? So, yeah.
No, exactly. For any filmmakers out there who are listening, who are neurotypical and want to make their sets and productions more accessible, are there any core things, like obviously I know you're not an advocate or anything like that, but are there any core things you just ask them to be aware of?
Gosh, it's a thing that everyone should always be thinking about it. Everyone should always be thinking, is my set accessible enough? And sometimes there's only so much you can do because if you don't have an awful lot of money, you only have so many options, and there are some places that just can't be accessible. But I think you have to make the effort to really meet people where they are. So just hire the people that are the best for the job. Like, you know, not in terms of, that's always a funny statement to say, because then people will be like, oh, well, it just so happened that it was all able-bodied people. And that's not what I mean. You know, it's like, really look through, hire the best people for the job, make sure that they are accommodated, because it's literally all we're looking for. Just make sure they're accommodated. If there is an issue, make sure that they are comfortable enough with you to trust you with that, because it's actually kind of vulnerability letting people know that this is an issue that you've got with something. So you have to, there has to be a level of trust there. So for sure, and don't infantilize people. It's such a horrible habit a lot of people have of infantilizing disabled people and neurodivergent people. It's like, no, they're not children. They just need support in a different way. Ask them what they need, because guess what? We know what we need. We do, more times than not. So, you know, treating people like human beings, making sure that you are doing as much as you can is about as much as you can do, really. Advocate. We have to advocate for people that can't advocate for themselves.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. How do you feel this industry in general handles mental health issues? It's obviously become quite a common theme of awareness in movies, but mm-hmm. actually on set, how have you observed that?
Gosh, it makes me think about the long hours at crews work, and how that is just it's not conducive to normal life, let alone to like proper mental health. It's just not. I don't see the way things currently are, you know, the standard way things are at the moment. I just can't see it continuing if they're really about that. Oh, but mental health, we need to take care of people's mental health. Because guess what? They're working 16 hours a day, and that doesn't include travel time between wherever they live and there. Like, that's not okay. It's just not. People not seeing their families for ages on end because their job is so crazy and they work so many hours. No, I think there needs to be, and at this point, I don't think, you know, private investors and producers and studios, I don't think they're going to take that initiative by themselves. It has to be something that has to be from like a government level. Like, it has to be a law. The way that there are laws about like the hours children work. If that law wasn't there, children would be working hours as long as adults. They will just take advantage of you until it's illegal not to. Yeah, so it's something that, because really I think the thing that we miss is that all the issues, every single one of the problems that we have in the film and TV industry are issues in the real world. They affect every area of our life. So you can't just get rid of it in the bubble of the creative industry. It has to be eradicated everywhere. So I think with the view of making sure that people are able to take care of their mental health, are able to have a good work-life balance, there has to be laws in place that say people cannot work more hours than this. They have to have this much rest time. You just need to do it. And it might cost more money, but guess what? That's what it is. You need human beings to still be human beings. You can't, you know, like the whole thing with Helena Hutchins, the tragedy of her getting shot. I mean, it was the crew walked out because they were being overworked. And crews are like the hardiest people out there because they work so much, so many hours. And this production was still, you know, still tightening the screw on them, essentially, that to the point that they walked out. It's not okay. It's not okay. So I honestly, I think it's a government level thing and needs to change at the very top. Otherwise it just won't, and it has to.
No, I completely agree. Do you think that this kind of hard work is romanticized in the film industry?
Yes, overly romanticized. But I think it's not just because of the film industry, though. I think it has to be romanticized because, and this is maybe slightly political, but it has to be romanticized just so that it keeps, you know, working classes going and working for the upper classes. It's romanticized in that way specifically so that it's like, oh, well, if they can do it for, you know, just a film, and films are super cool, you know, because people think it's all like premieres and stuff. No, it isn't. It's really, really hard work. But, you know, if people can do it for something as trivial as making a film, why can't they do it to you know, take care of their kids? Why can't they work 60 hours a week at the job that matters more, in quotes? It's romanticized, and I think it's romanticized on purpose, because if you're working constantly and you have to take care of your family, every spare moment is either work or family, or like the tiny bit of rest you get, you don't have the time or the capacity to think about other things. I mean, it's really interesting to me that the Black Lives Matter movement came back around after George Floyd was killed, because pretty much everyone was at home. People were working from home or they were on furlough. They now had time to really think about things. And there were riots all over the world. And so now it just seems a little funny to me that they're saying that, we're cutting down the days of self-isolation. And even if you have COVID, as long as you're asymptomatic, you should go to work. And, there's no more tests. And, just so long as people are busy and working to keep the economy going and to keep the system going, it's really devious and evil to me, honestly. It's done on purpose, absolutely done on purpose. And so, of course, it gets into the film industry as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No. Everything you're saying is so spot on. And as you said, people work ridiculous hours in this industry, absolutely ridiculous hours. And it's almost not possible to really have a work-life balance. What has your experience been like in terms of trying to figure it all out?
Exactly. And even I have found it difficult, but just because I have, you know, added support needs. But even just with writing, you can really, because the life of being a freelancer is not easy, because you have to take pretty much every opportunity to try and make a bit of money just to take care of yourself. So you wind up really burning yourself out. And that's something that I do a lot, which is terrible. Don't do it as much as you possibly can. But for me, because I'm not someone that has to be on a set all the time, it's, easier for me to try and set my own hours. But at the same time, like, hard work is hard work, you know? So even if I'm a night owl and I'm writing through the night, it's still, what kind of work-life balance is that? You know, it then means I have to sleep in the day, which means I can't run errands, I can't go grocery shopping, I can't go to the GP if I need to. Like, it affects everything. And I feel like then it's a little different for me as a writer, at least with crews, you know, they have to be in specific, they physically have to be there where I can write at home. But the work-life balance is still pretty challenging for early stage writers, people that don't have to be on set, because you know, that pressure of you can't say no, otherwise you won't get another opportunity like that, or you might not be able to pay that bill if you say no to this, even though you know that you're at capacity. So yeah, I think that's something else that needs to be addressed, and it, just the general treatment of freelancers needs to be addressed. Pay your freelancers on time, please. You know, it's just there are so many factors to it, but also that feeling of you have to pay your dues, you know, everyone struggles at first. I feel like, yeah, work, like you have to work a bit harder to sort of get the wheel going, but at a certain point, it's not feasible. It's not okay. Like one of my writer friends, I don't know how she manages. And I don't think this girl sleeps, because she's working for a production company. She's also writing her own TV pilot. She's on several schemes. And I'm like, how though? Like, I'm not doing nearly as much as her, and I feel like I'm doing too much. I don't. And it's just that feeling of you will be left behind if you do all that. And I feel like that needs to go. But that, I think that one, that's more on us more than anything else. Like, if we all banded together and we're like, you know what? No, it might work. But the nature of being freelance makes it difficult, because you just have to take whatever you can get. So,
yeah. Yeah, no, there's a lot that needs to change, and hopefully, you know, as the industry is starting to change, as new people are starting to come in, we can kind of put it through a washing machine and you know, start some new better habits and get some regulation in there, because that is the most important part.
Regulation is needed. I mean, just the same way it's regulated for children, where it's like you can only work so many hours as a child and no more, and children have to have chaperones, it needs to be the same for adults, because otherwise we just get taken advantage of.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it, you know, for any normal person looking at some of the apps, like I recently had someone tell me that she worked like nearly 100 hours in like a week. And, you know, she's a mother, and she couldn't see her kids. And, you know, it's in any other, like, in irregular employment, that wouldn't be legal. So, you know,
it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable. It's just that it hits neurodivergent people more quickly, because already we're trying to mold ourselves to fit into something that, you know, doesn't fit us and was never supposed to fit us. But it doesn't, it's not sustainable for neurotypical people either. It's just not.
I wanted to briefly talk about, and I'll link it down below so people can read it. There's a really interesting article you wrote for the Black Ballad about how oppressive systems have used storytelling to hack our brains. Tell me just briefly about your discovery of this influence.
Ooh, this was, interestingly, this was when I went to a screenwriting conference in Atlanta whilst I was doing my MA. So this was early 2019. And there's a guy, oddly enough, he's from here and he works here. He's John York. And he wrote a book called Into the Woods, which is all about the why of story structure, why story structure works. It is brilliant. Everyone and their mum needs to read it. It doesn't matter if you're not a writer. It doesn't matter if you're not a screenwriter. It's such a brilliant book. Everybody needs to read it. But he was doing a talk at this screenwriting conference, and it was something that he mentioned, and I was like, oh my gosh, he is so right about how things are framed, about the stories that are allowed to be told, and how, you know, when it's constant enough, people just assume it's the truth and don't even think about it anymore. It's just that the way our brains work, we are just, human beings are lazy people when it comes to like how the brain works. Where I think I remember my psychology, one of my psychology tutors said we were cognitive misers. And it's true. We just take the path of least resistance to anything and everything, right? And it was just so fascinating to really realize that, wow, they really take advantage of the fact that that's how our brains work, in order to have us have an emotional response to something, then that way we're not thinking about logically what it is. Because another thing with logic, it's a lot of effort. It's effort to think about things logically. So that also comes back to people working so many hours. How do you have time to think about things logically? It's only if you see something, say if you see something on Twitter that just makes you completely irate. It could be absolutely anything. That feeling has taken over. That's what you remember. That's what sort of imprints on whatever it is that you read. That's the impression that you have. Even if you thought about it logically, it's really difficult to remove that emotion sort of once it's laid hold. So unless you get into that habit of really consciously critiquing everything that you read, which we don't want to do, it's a lot of work to consciously critique every single thing that we read. We don't want to do it. That's why, you know, it works when, you know, there are people who are genuinely struggling, who are being left behind by the government, and all they read in their newspapers is immigrants are taking your jobs. Of course they're going to believe that, because they don't have the time to break it down and think about logic. It's all part of the same game. The system plays the exact same game on everyone. And even by the time, even if you're able to explain it logically to someone, they don't necessarily care, because the fact is they feel that way, and it's easier to feel than to really think something through. So that was when John York sort of put that together about storytelling, and the whole idea is to have people feel, and they're not thinking about the plot holes in your story. They're like, oh man, it really is just, we just hacked people's brains. That's the whole point. That's what puts bums in seats. That's what has people pay money to go and sit in a dark room for a few hours and watch something. That is the point of storytelling more than anything else. And that's something that really, really impressed on me, the fact that I really have a responsibility to not just tell whatever story. I have to really look out for the audiences and know that whatever they, you know, step away, whenever they step away from whatever story that I've been telling them, I need them to have a certain impression. there's nothing that's ever going to be completely without bias. There's nothing that's ever going to completely lead them to be like, oh, well, it could be this, could be that. It's pretty rare that that happens. But really, you're trying to send a message and you are convincing them with their emotions for the most part. And it's something that if you, you know, if you were to be careless with that, you could really create a lot more trouble than not. Because, you know, if like little things, like if you're not familiar with a group of people. So let's say, you know, I think this is particularly prevalent in America. I could be wrong, but it's where, you know, a white person can go their whole lives and never be friends with a black person, never interact with a black person. So all they ever see of a black person is like, I don't know, films. And so how are we being represented in films? And then you see how bad representation is, and you see how easily racism is then perpetuated because they have had no experience. So all they're seeing is this. And it's like, oh, that's what it is? Okay, easy enough to believe because, you know, they feel it to be true. So it's that that's really made me think about the fact that we need to be responsible in storytelling and really, you know, point out the problematic aspects of whatever story is being told. And there's nothing wrong with pointing out problematic aspects. I think everybody has blind spots everywhere. So people need to not be so defensive if someone's like, this is problematic, maybe let's not do this. You know, that defensiveness needs to go. We're trying to make the world a better place. So
no, exactly. So what is it that you hope to explore and achieve with your work? I know that you have a very psychological approach and like to explore, you know, power dynamics and injustices and such.
Gosh, I think because those the kinds of stories that sort of come naturally to me, because I love big epic stories, but I'm also scared to write them, so I don't. But you know, the kinds of stories that kind of I naturally like to tell are, you know, particularly stories about kind of female anger, you know, not really knowing where you fit in, like identity issues sort of thing, being an outsider when you don't want to be an outsider. Those kinds of stories really hit with me. And I think what I really want to do in all the stories I tell is to let people know that they can always be within. No one ever has to be on the outside forever. And sometimes that might mean that you need to learn a hard lesson. Sometimes that means that other people need to learn how to accommodate you. But the fact is, we all belong. And I think it's hard to really feel like you belong sometimes. And I think this is the case of a lot of writers, because a lot of us are just sort of on the outside looking in, observing people. But I think really at the end of the day, my big ambition is to have any person that likes my storytelling to know that they belong somewhere. They come from somewhere and they belong somewhere. No one is ever really alone. Even if they feel that way, it's not true. So I'm trying to help them to feel not alone as much as possible. So yeah, I think that's my aim, really. Yeah.
And so on that note, can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming work with Redeeming Features, who, of course, are the production company behind this very podcast? Yeah. Shameless plug.
Yeah, no, right. It's very new. Like, I'm still, you know, I sent a pilot script that I wrote, which is called Deliver Me. And I'm trying not to spoil it, but it's essentially about a midwife who makes a grave error when she discovers by accident that her husband is cheating on her. And this the aim of this particular story is to interrogate that sense of white saviorism, but like particularly female white saviorism, because that's not talked about a lot. But it can be really insidious because it's not talked about a lot. So it's something that I want her to wind up being a bit of a fish out of water, and she has to learn that actually, you know, it's not her place to take charge in places that she's not from. There are other people there who have been there who know better than her, even if she doesn't think so. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm trying to go with this midwife story. So that's something else that I've, you know, given along, and we'll see what Redeeming Features thinks about it. But, you know, apart from that, I'm just sort of brainstorming ideas and, you know, seeing what we can do. And then of course my short film is in post-production now, which is Yay. So yeah, so it's called Her Midas Touch. And it's sort of, has a bit of a supernatural element, but also the themes of it's a family of two, black Scottish family of two, grandmother and granddaughter. And it's a story about, them being beaten down by the system and them having to take on emotional labor as a way to give themselves a bit of, rest from the system being so aggressively on top of them. Yeah, I know that doesn't give anything away, right? But at least that's in post-production, so that's something else I've learned a lot from, sort of producing that. So yes, things are going well. So that I would eventually probably, see if Redeeming Features might be interested in a longer form version of Her Midas Touch. So we shall see.
Very interesting things coming in the future, I can see. And as for the industry, are there any, changes you'd like to see? Any New Year's resolutions on behalf of the industry?
Gosh, everything, turn it upside down, burn down Hollywood for one. I'm sorry, but
Everything we've talked about, yeah.
exactly, pretty much. I think it just needs to be humane. That's literally it. I mean, yeah, be humane, treat human beings like human beings, and we have lives, we have families. It's not fair that it's the people at the top who are making the most money who also get to spend time with their families. So, so yeah, it's just be humane, look out for your fellow man, pretty much.
No, definitely. And so talking about, reflections and such, what's your favorite film of 2021?
Ooh. Okay, I'm gonna have to say In the Heights, because there are lots of films I haven't seen yet. I love musicals. I adore musicals. And I have seen, I did have some issues with it. And also, I thought the stage version was better because they did some stuff with some of the character relationships that was not so great in the film, I thought. But I had a great time watching it. And as a good film does, like, it hits you in the feels, So, yeah, I'd have to say In the Heights. This year, it's been such a long year, and it was just nice to go in and watch something joyful, which lots of color, lots of music. It was just lovely. So yeah.
Interesting, interesting. It was one that had so much talk around it when it first came out, and then now when everyone's talking about awards, it's completely out of the conversation.
Long, isn't it? Really strange, I thought, because especially because Lin-Manuel Miranda is really like hot right now, so it's really odd that I'm actually talking about it. But yeah.
Yeah, they were like, we can only have one.
I know, right?
Would you ever be interested in doing a musical?
Oh, absolutely. I have an idea for a musical. I'm not, I cannot write it right now, but I'm absolutely writing one. And it's like, yeah, I have an idea for it. I know how I want it to go. I just need, yeah, I'm doing a musical, basically.
Brilliant, brilliant. Are there any filmmakers you think people should be, keeping their eye on that you can see are like gonna be great in the next few years?
Oh man,
Big question.
it's a really big question. So I'm just gonna have to go with the person that first came to mind. I watched, well, first of all, actually, a Scottish female director. Her first feature film is coming out, called The Banquet. It's she directed it. She's called Ruth Paxton. Definitely, I'm so excited to see it. It looks really, really good. I'm just like, oh. So yeah, definitely people need to watch out for her because it's played at several prestigious festivals and it looks genuinely terrifying. I really want to see it. So definitely people need to watch out for her. But the other person that first popped into my mind is a guy called Kieran Lyons. I watched a short of his that he did, was it last year or the year before? But it was called The Motorist. One of the weirdest things I've ever seen, and I enjoyed it so much. I really, really loved it because I feel like it could very easily have been like very abstract and confusing, but somehow it all worked like in a narrative way, and it was so weird, like it was something different. I loved it. I really, really loved it. So I'm not sure if he's coming out with a feature or anything, but if anyone can find that short, The Motorist by Kieran Lyons, absolutely give it a watch because it's so bizarre. I love it.
Amazing, amazing. And as always, we like to, you know, get a shout out to a woman in the industry who inspires you.
Oh, but there are so many.
I know.
Okay, right. Let me just mention a couple. Right. Okay. So first of all, the woman who directed my short, Her Midas Touch, she's Victoria Thomas. Love her. Absolutely love her. And I can't even begin to tell you how much I look up to her. I mean, genuinely, she's so brilliant. I just adore her. And she's got all sorts of things coming out as well. So Victoria, our DOP on Her Midas Touch, Kirsten McMahon. Fantastic. Adore her as well. I mean, her work was just brilliant. And we were constantly like pushed for time. And she produced such fantastic work with the cinematography. Just amazing. And a couple more shout outs, because really without these two people, I wouldn't still be writing. So Uzma Mir, she is a producer. She's worked for the BBC for years. And I happened to work with her for like as an extra for a documentary she was doing. And she was one of those people that really made me feel really included. And so when I was getting into writing, like she agreed to have a coffee with me, just to have, you know, a chat, which was just lovely. And then Raisa Ahmed, who, because of her, I carried on writing, because I think at the point that she was like, oh, come to the table read anyway, I think I would have given up because I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. So really, like without, you know, Raisa and Uzma, I think I wouldn't be writing and I wouldn't have done the MA and I wouldn't be here today. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And for the aspiring women and those, anyone who's listening right now, do you have a last message you'd want to give?
Ooh, last message, create your space. Carve out a space for yourself, because the fact is there is room enough for everyone. They make it seem like that forced, you know, scarcity is a lie. Create your space, do your thing. There's more than enough room for you. So just get up and do it.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Thank you so much for talking with me today. Lastly, where can people find you? Is there anything you want to plug, promote?
Gosh, I guess my Twitter, because I'm mostly on Twitter. So I'm at Lorna_King, keeping it simple, on Twitter. And anyone can pretty much just at me, because a lot of people have reached out to me on Twitter. They were looking for advice or whatever. So feel free. Feel free to get in contact if you like.
Incredible, incredible. Thank you so much for sitting down, for sharing your journey with us today. It's been so insightful and so much fun. Making It Women in Film is hosted by Malin Evita, produced in collaboration with her and Redeeming Features. Our production supervisor is Ruth Aitken. Research is by Lauren San Miguel. Shania Bethune and Abby Weiss are our production assistants. If you enjoy our show, please remember to subscribe and leave a review. You can also support the show by posting about us on your social media and following us on Instagram at Making It Women in Film. If you have any questions or feedback, DM us or email us at miwif.feedback@gmail.com. For more, visit womeninfilm.co.uk or redeemingfeatures.co.uk. Everything will be linked down in the show notes. Thank you, and we'll see you next Tuesday for another episode of Making It Women in Film.